How can you achieve and maintain business growth? Harvard Business School Executive Education is now accepting applications for a new program, Driving Profitable Growth. Taking place in Boston from October 25th through the 28th, this program focuses on business expansion and organizational growth strategies that can lead your company into the future. Learn more about this three-day program for senior leaders by visiting hbs.me/growth. That's hbs.me/growth.
You are Locked On Thunder, your daily podcast on the Oklahoma City Thunder, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Hello there, everyone. We're locked in for episode 187 of Locked On Thunder, presented by the Norman Transcript. I'm your host, Fred Katz. Locked On Thunder is part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Head on to iTunes, search Locked On Thunder, subscribe to the podcast there, and leave a review once you're on that page. You can also find us on audioboom.com. Log on to normantranscript.com. Check out my blog, Thunder Road. It's under the sports tab on the site. You can see all my Thunder coverage there. I'm on every day of the week, Monday through Friday, recording this one. This will be Tuesday morning's episode. I just recorded a long conversation with Locked On Rockets host Ben DuBose. We talked about tons of stuff, Thunder defense and the switching strategies, what they can do different in game twos, Rocket stuff, obviously, Harden, Westbrook, what happened in practice today, what they're thinking about doing differently, all that kind of stuff. Going to get to that conversation in one quick moment. But first, before I do, I just want to take a quick second to tell you guys about SeatGeek, because buying tickets online for sports and concerts has been a confusing process for a long time. It's always been hard to find the best deals for that game or show you want to go to, and none of those older ticket sites want to change that. But SeatGeek is different. They've come along and created an amazing app and website that makes it easier than ever for fans to buy and sell tickets. SeatGeek is always the first place I go to look for tickets to a game or concert. I have the SeatGeek app on my phone, and I just used it recently to buy tickets for Tom Petty, going to be in Oklahoma City on Thursday night. It's a Thunder off night. Really excited about that. Everything about SeatGeek is designed to make life easier for sports and music fans. SeatGeek does all the price comparison for you by searching multiple ticket sites and ensuring that you get the best possible deal. SeatGeek does all the work and you save the time and money. And SeatGeek wants to help you get the most bang for your buck. That's why every ticket on SeatGeek is given a grade based on value. You'll immediately see any underpriced seats and be able to find the best deals that fit your budget. Best of all, my listeners get a $20 rebate off their first SeatGeek purchase. To get your $20 rebate on tickets, download the SeatGeek app, go to the settings tab, and click add a promo code. Enter the promo code LO Thunder. That's LO like locked on, and SeatGeek is going to give you $20 after you've made your first ticket purchase. Download the SeatGeek app and enter the promo code LO Thunder today. Quick break, and then let's get to that conversation with Ben.
You are Locked On Thunder, your daily Oklahoma City Thunder podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Fred, how's everything going today, man?
I'm good. How about you?
Probably better than you. The Rockets had the day off here in Houston. Of course, the Thunder had a little bit more business to take care of after that game last night. So you guys were busy at practice today. How was it? Anything new? I assume everybody's eager to try and find some sort of solution to what happened to the Thunder last night.
There's never anything new. You know how practice goes. You go there, you ask questions, they give you cliche answers, and that's about all it goes. My guess is that, there was one thing that kind of caught my attention from practice today, and it was that Billy Donovan said that Enes Kanter and Steven Adams weren't switching on Harden pick and rolls, which was not true. And I think what he meant was they weren't supposed to switch. Which is interesting, because that means that at some point lines got crossed up. Like, either Adams and Kanter thought they were supposed to do it and they weren't, or they just started doing it for some strange reason. We didn't get to talk. I didn't get to ask you either of those guys why at practice, so couldn't find out their side of the story. But I thought that was an interesting thing, because the Thunder don't normally switch on pick and rolls. Maybe they were confused. Maybe they felt like they had to start doing it. Maybe Donovan accidentally misspoke during that practice. Although he was pretty definitive on Adams and Kanter are not supposed to switch. Maybe he just kind of said that, hoping nobody would notice, and maybe they're not going to switch from with their centers in games two and moving forward. But that was really the only thing that came out of practice for me, and that was really just the basketball Burton nerd in me digging in over all else.
No, that's really interesting to me, actually. That's one of the questions I was going to lead with, because the strategy that Oklahoma City employed last night, I've watched Mike D'Antoni's Rockets for 90 games now, 82 regular season, the 7 in the preseason, the game last night. That was the most unique defensive strategy I've seen employed yet, and it didn't go particularly well. And what was weird about it to me was that, as you said, they switched on seemingly everything. I mean, it's definitely not true what Donovan said, because so many times throughout the game, of course, there was the clip of Harden and Kanter that got bined and shared a million times. But you had Steven Adams and Kanter coming away from the basket, defending Harden one-on-one so many occasions without a lot of help. And it seemed to put Oklahoma City behind the eight ball in a couple areas. Number one, it let Harden, and to a lesser extent Pat Beverly, have driving lanes to the bucket. And on a secondary level, it took those big guys away from the basket, which gave Houston more opportunities for offensive rebounds and second chance points than you would expect against a team with Steven Adams, Enes Kanter, and the kind of big bodies that Oklahoma City can throw down low. So my theory, and this is just me and you talking, Fred, you can kind of give your speculation as to what might work heading into game two. But I'm wondering if you need to switch a little bit less, because to me, the route for the Thunder winning would seem to be giving up at least a few threes and hoping that the Rockets are just simply cold on that particular night. What it seemed like the Thunder tried to do with that scheme last night, they did not want to give up threes. We know what happened when these two teams played most recently in the regular season, late March at Toyota Center. That was when the Rockets made 20 threes, shot over 50% from behind the arc. It seemed like they were just couldn't miss that night. So it looked like to me last night the Thunder were not going to give up those threes. They did a decent job preventing. They didn't leave shooters. They didn't double off that much. The Rockets didn't get their usual open looks. But as a consequence of doing that, they just gave up far too many driving lanes. So my suspicion going into game two is that one of the adjustments for the Thunder is maybe not to switch as much, maybe to occasionally, if not double, hedge, do something to prevent the driving lanes that James Harden and Pat Beverly got last night. And so I'm curious your thoughts on that, and, well, if anything you saw at practice today might play into that theory at all.
You know, I'm not completely against the switching. Donovan's getting killed for it. The Thunder are getting killed for it. I thought the execution was really bad.
Yeah.
I think if the execution is better, that looks a lot better schematically. Now, I think there were times where they actually were supposed to help off of shooters, and they just didn't.
Yes.
And their backline help was non-existent. And I think it was in part because they were so scared of Houston's shooters, and they were so... You know, they were so dug into a new defensive scheme, which they don't, it's not like they're running around switching on pick and rolls all season. That's the first time they've done that all year. So I think they're a little confused. They're trying to figure out, all right, how do we make this work during a postseason game when we haven't done this for the first 82 games of the year? I think they're trying to figure that kind of stuff out, which is a reasonable thing. But execution wise, they were really bad. They were really bad. There were times where guys could have helped from the corners or could have helped from the wings, and it didn't happen. Their communication was way off. They messed up a lot of those switches. That's the thing. There are a lot of times where two, you know, a big man and the guy who's supposed to be defending the ball, both of them just rolled with the roll man, and you leave the ball handler wide open on the perimeter. That happened a few times, and vice versa. That's how Clint Capella got, like, you know, 48 lobs that he got to finish. There are a lot of times where communication-wise, they just messed up. And communication, they sometimes have an issue with. Steven Adams made a joke like a month ago, which always stuck with me, which was like, you know, the guards, they never listen to me. They never listen to me. And he was joking because he's Steven Adams and he's rarely serious about anything because he's just a goofy guy. But there was a hint of truth in that. And ever since then, I've been kind of looking at it. It's like, okay, I spot out the moments where the guards don't listen to Steven Adams. And I don't think it's necessarily on Adams' side of communication. I think it's more on the side of listening to the communication and reacting to the communication. Russell Westbrook wasn't good in this game defensively. I mean, he wasn't good offensively either. But he wasn't good in this game defensively, and it's not like he's a great defensive player to begin with. And I think communication-wise, they, aside from Andre Robertson, who I thought did a really good job, I think communication-wise, they were just totally off, and that really hurt them. If you're going to switch like that, if you're going to employ something that aggressive to where you're switching, like even before this, not even before the screen is set, before like a guy could potentially even slip a screen, if you're switching that early and that promptly, you need your communication to be perfect, and it just wasn't.
Yeah, I would agree with that. You certainly can switch, but there are some caveats that have to apply. I thought, as you said, the communication wasn't good. I think we all remember the sequence that ended with the one of the Capella lobs, where if you notice the TV camera, I'm sure you saw this retweeted on Twitter, it looked like caught Billy saying, "Can't play Cantor," you know, and that was in reference to the lack of communication, the lack of switching, whatever you want to call it. But the bigger picture thing that I took out of it is, yeah, when you had those bigs switch onto Harden, it's not that it can't work, but you at least need someone else willing to at least hedge, show a little bit, do something to cut off the driving lane. But it just seemed like, I don't know what it was. Maybe it's a lack of communication. Maybe it's the lack of familiarity after not really playing that style all year long. Maybe it's being a little shell-shocked after how well Houston shot the ball in that late March game. But for whatever reason, you didn't have any sort of secondary help at all. And to some extent, you can't stop everything. You have to give Houston something, and you'd rather, in my opinion, give up, you know, a Ryan Anderson three than just an uncontested driving lane to the bucket for James Harden or Pat Beverly. And so I would assume that's kind of the goal in game two. It's not that you have to go away from switching entirely. It's just you have to take at least some steps to cut off just those completely unmitigated driving lanes that the Rockets guards had last night.
It's a personnel thing. It's a personnel thing, too. Sorry to cut you off. It's a personnel thing also, right? Like, sure. That's not, like you said, can't play Cantor. Like, this is not the series for Enes Kanter. But you know what? We didn't see minutes with Taj Gibson at the five last night. That wasn't the thing that happened. I thought we were going to see lineups with Gibson at the five and Jeremy Grant at the four. And Jeremy Grant got a nice amount of minutes, but Gibson played 20, 21 minutes. I kind of thought this was going to be a series where, and I still do, I think it's going to be a series where Taj Gibson's defensive versatility, his ability to go out and switch onto wings and such on the perimeter, is something that's going to help them. And I think you can play Taj Gibson at the five against even Houston's starting lineup. I think you can do that. You can put Grant on Ryan Anderson. That's fine. You can put Grant on Trevor Ariza when he's playing a four position, a three position, whatever. Like, that's fine. Grant is versatile enough with that, and you can switch. That's a lineup. If you want to switch everything, that's a lineup. If you play Westbrook and Oladipo and Robertson and Grant and Gibson, that's a lineup which size-wise is okay with matching up against that starting lineup, and you can switch everything and you can be okay. Now, it's not necessarily going to help you with the rebounding a whole ton, but if you're getting stops, then that's really the main objective.
And that's right where I was trying to go anyway. I was trying to transition to talking personnel, and I've seen some folks on Twitter say, well, if Oklahoma City can't get any traction, why not try going big with that dual lineup of both Adams and Cantor to see if you can just basically make it a slugfest and completely take Houston out of their style. It sounds like you don't see that as all that likely. If anything, it sounds like you would expect them to try and maybe go a little bit smaller, which we did not see in game one. The Taj Gibson at the five, which I would agree would seem to have a little more success than just an ultra big lineup. With the way Houston plays and the volume of shooters, I think the Adams-Cantor dual big lineup kind of reeks of desperation. But I've seen some folks throwing it out there as a possibility, so that's what I wanted to bounce off and kind of see what the pulse from the Oklahoma City side was on that.
Yeah, there's no way that would work.
Yeah.
Whoever threw that out, I mean, there's a very simple explanation as to why that wouldn't work, and it's because three is more than two.
Yeah.
And if you have Adams and Cantor out there, good luck with Enes Kanter. Whether he's playing the four or playing the five, good luck with Adams playing the four. And it's like, we're talking about how Adams was struggling to play the five. Good luck with Adams playing the four. Good luck with Cantor playing the five. I mean, we're having a conversation right now about, can Cantor get any minutes during this series? Like, I don't see how that could possibly work. I mean, put it in perspective. If that lineup gives up four threes, they give up four threes to Houston, that means they need to get six twos on the other end just to make it up. I mean, it's not a viable strategy at all. It's not just the threes, it's that you know, Cantor gets turned around, and it just is not a viable defensive lineup by any means. I don't think it can work. The reason that lineup works, you can't just go big against a small lineup and have it work if you don't have versatility on both ends of the floor. You can do that if you have versatility on both ends of the floor, but those kinds of players are rare. Enes Kanter is a great offensive player, but he's not that player on the defensive end. He's just not, and it doesn't work. Like, just like you can't just say, all right, this team is big, let's go small and put Andre Robertson at the four. Like, the Thunder can't do that, because while Andre Robertson is going small is not just your size, it's your skill set. And, like, yes. While Andre Roberson is small and he's a 2-3 and they play him at the 4 sometimes, no one's going to be like, oh, no, Robertson's the 4. Now we have to go guard the perimeter against Andre Roberson. No one's going to say that because Andre Roberson's a 24% three-point shooter, except for last night when he was
the hottest
he's ever been in his life. So it's about skill set. It's about skill set. It's not size. It's skill set. Big and small are terms to you know, explain skill sets, and those skill sets just don't match up.
Yeah, I would definitely tend to agree with that. I saw it thrown out there essentially as an act of desperation. But to me, yeah, there are other things you try well before that, because I can't fathom a scenario with the way Houston plays and the ball movement and the shooting that at all works. And particularly Kanter's defensive liabilities are a big part of that. Turning to the other side of the ball, Russell Westbrook, you expect some defensive issues with him, but I don't think you would expect him to struggle offensively the way he did last night. What's the prescription to get him turned around? As a Houston fan, I know he missed a few shots that essentially you would not expect him to miss every single game. But what really stands out from the Houston side of things and the way Houston fans are looking at this is how poorly the Rockets, not named Pat Beverly, are at guarding Russell Westbrook. I know they tried Eric Gordon, but those possessions did not go especially well. So it seems like, to me, besides the obvious answer of just make a few more shots, one of the keys, if Westbrook and the Thunder can pick up some cheap fouls on Beverly, that might be the route to get him going, because I don't really see anyone else on the Houston roster that's even remotely capable of checking Russell on his way to the bucket if they can take Beverly out of the equation.
Yeah, I mean, look, Beverly's great. He's an incredible defensive player. He's really fantastic. His energy is unbelievable. His physicality on the ball is amazing. The way he fights through screens is great. I think you have to go right at him, though. Like, it's almost the same strategy as they say when you go up against a great shot blocker, you go into his chest, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Russ, especially in the first, like, quarter and a half, it was all jump shots.
Yep.
It was all jump shots. And when Russell Westbrook's taking jump shots, you're happy. Like, if you're a defense, you're happy with that. Like, that's what you want. You want him pulling up for those 20-footers, especially a defense like Houston, which, you know, thinks that, you know, a mid-range shot is as good as dirt. That's their entire defensive philosophy, right? So if you're putting up Russell Westbrook, who shot under 35% from mid-range this year, if he's settling for those jumpers and he's settling for contested threes and all that, like, that's not the game you want. You want to get Beverly into foul trouble. You want to keep him on his feet. You want that change of pace. You want to use the explosion to your advantage. And I think in some ways Russ was a little frustrated with Beverly. I think he was frustrated with the way that they were guarding him just super physically.
Mm-hmm.
I think Beverly's the only point guard in the league that frustrates him. Every other point guard in the league, every time a point guard guards him, he like salivates. Every single time. There are a couple wings who will frustrate him. Beverly's, I think, the only point guard who frustrates him. And I think he was frustrating him when they were picking him up full court and all that stuff. I don't expect the same thing to happen in game two, though. It's the same thing as Harden, though. Like,
sure.
Sometimes, most of the time, actually, when one of these guys, you know, someone of Westbrook's or Harden's or, you know, LeBron, KD, whoever else, Kawhi, those guys, they have a bad game. It's usually more on them than it is on the defense. And that's not to say that the defense was not – Beverly played a tremendous, tremendous game. But when a guy like Russ or Harden is on, the defense doesn't quite matter because Harden makes tough shots and Russ makes tough shots. And if Russ wants to get to the rim, almost doesn't matter how good the defense you're playing on him is, he's probably going to do it a decent amount of times. And he just wasn't quite doing it. In game one, I think he's probably going to do it in game two because it's not that often. Usually when he has a game like he did the other night, he comes back and plays really well in the next one. It's not that often you see back-to-back really bad games against him or really bad games from him.
Yeah, and I thought you hit the nail on the head with the logic of taking it right at him. I enjoy watching Pat Beverly. He's so unique. But the thing about him, you can use that aggressiveness against him at times. We saw it in that span in the second quarter when things got a little chippy. That was when Beverly picked up his second foul. And that was the time that it felt like Russell was about to gain some traction. And for whatever reason, he never really did. But I thought that was a good example of what he can do to have some success. You know, you use that aggressiveness against him. If you get a couple of fouls on Beverly, even if Russell still struggles from the field at the outset, I think getting Beverly out of the game is kind of a ticket to establishing a little more rhythm, continuity, and from there, I don't want to say that he needs to gain confidence. I think Russell is as confident as any player in the game, but at least generate a little bit of positive momentum for his team once he sees a few shots go down. Because, yeah, Beverly, as great as he is, he's not going to be able to hold Russ to that every game. That's certainly a one-off, and I don't think anyone in Houston even would disagree with that characterization.
Yeah.
Fred, we spent most of this podcast talking about the Thunder because, of course, the onus is obviously on Billy Donovan to make changes after you lose by 30 points in game one. We all know how that goes. Flip side, we haven't talked that much about the Rockets, so, you know, what do you guys think about the Rockets? What are questions you have? What surprised you in game one? We haven't talked that much about the Rockets in particular. So I was curious what stood out about them. Anything you want to talk about from the Houston side of the fence?
Yeah. I want to hear your opinion on I want to hear your opinion on 33 three-point shots because that's not a lot for them. If the Thunder come out with the same defensive strategy, if there's one thing you can say about them that they did well defensively in this game, it's that they at least, who cares about 10 for 33 or 11 for 33, whatever they were. Defenses, for the most part, can't limit three-point percentage. They can limit three-point attempts. And the impressive part of the Thunder defense, the one thing you can say, all right, they did that well. They limited three-point attempts from the team that chucks up more threes by far than any team in the history of the NBA. If the Thunder come out with the same defensive strategy or a similar, like an adjusted version of the same defensive strategy, you know, they shore up some things. Maybe Adams specifically doesn't switch quite as much. They change some personnel. Maybe they help off the wings a little bit more often. But for the most part, they're doing the same thing. If you're Houston, how are you getting back into that rhythm to where you can take your 43s a game, your 45 threes a game, or do you not care? Do you just go with what the Thunder are giving you, or do you try to force in some more threes?
For now, you keep taking it to the rim until they prove you can stop it. That was the problem last night. Yeah, it was a really good defensive game plan. It was as good as any team all year from the standpoint of limiting not just the volume of threes, but quality looks, period. I thought even to get to the 33 figure, Houston had to really force some in there. They didn't get the quality of looks, but the flip side is because of how Oklahoma City did it, you had these driving lanes to the rim. And so I think Houston's going to keep doing it until it's stopped. Now, as we talked about earlier, there are obviously some steps that Oklahoma City can take to not make those driving lanes quite as open. The other thing, there's a reason Pat Beverly does not average 20-plus points per game. Is Pat going to have that level of success every game as a basically secondary creator after James Harden? That remains to be seen. Maybe it's a little bit better in this series because – you know, as you said earlier, there are obviously certain deficiencies that Russell Westbrook has on the defensive side. So we'll see what happens there. In general, though, I think it's a fairly sound. You may have to give up a few more threes in order to really take away the driving lanes. But in general, I think it's a pretty sound theory. It's just, as you said earlier, the execution didn't really work. I think the main thing that you want to see from Oklahoma City and one of the concerns here in Houston, it's been a while since either Lou Williams or Eric Gordon really got going. Like that game in late March when Oklahoma City came here, that was probably the one game in the last month when Lou was really hot. Well, I think there's another in Phoenix, the one game that Harden sat out. But other than that, he's been pretty bad. Also, Gordon the last 3 months. Eric Gordon has not really shot that well from three. So the Rockets as a whole, Ryan Anderson came in hot. I know he was cold in game one, but he's been hot since coming back from the sprained ankle. But a lot of their shooters, most notably Lou Williams, Eric Gordon, those bench creators, they really haven't been very good. So if I'm Oklahoma City, I would want to make those guys beat me. And so I think maybe that's the game plan. You don't want to give them stationary shots. So you want to make them make some plays off the dribble. And so I thought they did a pretty good job of that. Certainly, I believe Gordon was 3 of 8. Lou was 3 of 11. They took a lot of awkward shots, especially in the mid-range game. So I thought there were some definite positives to Oklahoma City defensively. It's just the really easy driving lanes for Harden just kind of took away all of it. And then once Harden got hot in the second half, he threw in some threes that, quite frankly, were pretty well guarded and just went in because Harden's one of those guys, just like you said earlier with Russ, once he gets hot, he's capable of throwing in just about anything. That's just how it goes. So, yeah, it was a pretty solid game plan for Oklahoma City, and I you know, I could see certain elements of it working going forward, because until those bench guys, until Lou and Eric, I know they've been, you know, sixth man of the year front runners for most of the season, but until they get it going, it's safe to essentially dare them to create and make life hard on them, because they certainly have not been to their season averages for several months now.
I'm so curious to see what Capella is going to do in the next game. Just because, you know, we talked about not helping off of shooters and that kind of stuff. And that's not just the driving lanes. It was also the rolling lanes. So those line, like the reason those lobs were open were not just botched switches. It was also because, like we talked about, guys weren't coming off the, coming out of the corner. They're not pulling over. They're not pulling over on those lobs and those rolls. And Capella has those lobs open. I'm so curious to see what he does. I'm so curious to see what Nene does. Like the Nene just, I guess Nene just kills the Thunder at this point. I guess that's just the thing.
He's literally shooting almost 80% in five games now. It's just ridiculous against Oklahoma City. It's just absolutely nuts. But yeah, the Capella thing is the bigger enigma to me. When the Rockets struggled in late March, and kind of the ultimate asterisk you have to throw on any Rockets struggle talk, because of course they've been locked into the three seed for a while. You also had James Harden playing with a wrist injury that he re-aggravated in that Thunder game that we've been talking about in late March. So their struggles, you know, you kind of have to throw an asterisk on it. But when they're at their worst against the Warriors and Blazers, they had a three-game losing streak in there. They're only one of the year. Capella did not look good. He looked like he lost a little bit of confidence. He wasn't hitting from the line. He got stripped far too easily going up. But they had him rest two games last week. They tried to really downplay it, but they mentioned that he had a very minor Achilles tweak. But since then, after he rested, coming back, his last two games of the regular season, Sacramento and Minnesota, not exactly great teams, but some pretty talented big men, most notably Karl Anthony Towns in there, and Capella was just dominant in those games. One of them was like a plus 28, by far the best on the roster. And basically since coming back, and that flowed into game one, he's looked a ton more confident, a lot better on both ends of the floor. He had the highlight block against Russell Westbrook as well. So I don't know if he's healthier now. Like I said, they really tried to downplay the Achilles tweak. And to an extent, every player has some sort of sore spot at this point in the NBA season anyway. But yeah, Capella has looked a ton better in the last 7 to 10 days than what we saw of him, you know, before that. So I'd say for Houston, it's one game of the playoffs. You don't want to make a mountain out of anything this early. But yeah, that's a real source of encouragement for the Rockets, because going into this series, everybody felt good about Nene, because as you said, for whatever reason, Nene just seems to thrive in this matchup. But Capella has been up and down. There were a couple of games, especially early on, where the Rockets actually had to play Montrezl Harrell a lot of minutes against the Thunder, because you could tell that Mike D'Antoni and Jeff Bezdelic, they just didn't fully trust Capella to make the necessary defensive rotations against the Thunder. But yesterday, I thought, was a real positive game for Clint, not just from the standpoint of scoring, but it seemed like he was smooth on his defensive rotations. And it just felt like, to me, watching, that you could see D'Antoni and Bezdelic gaining a little more trust in Capella in that matchup. And so given that he has length that Montrezl Harrell does not, I think that's potentially a big deal for the Rockets the rest of this series, because Nene is one of those guys. Nene, he's good, but there's a point of diminishing returns. If you expect much more than 25 minutes from him, you're going to have some problems. So you got to fill at least half the game with either Clint Capella or Montrezl Harrell. So I thought seeing Clint play as well as he did in game one, certainly a big positive for Mike D'Antoni and the Rockets.
Capella's good. He's a much better offensive player than people give him credit for. He's really, really good as a role man. Like he's gotten really good at finding space, at routing to the basket, at finishing those lobs. He's really good. I think he's 22. I feel like, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, I feel like he's going to figure out defense. He's got the physical talent. He's got the length. He's got the athleticism. He's got the foot speed. And you see him make those correct rotations, you're like, he's 22 years old. Think about where he is at 22 compared to where DeAndre Jordan was at 22.
Sure.
Like, DeAndre didn't really become, well, DeAndre Jordan until he was like 25, 26, like until Doc got there, you know? They're similar types of players. They're pick and roll, roll man. He's not as good of a screener as DeAndre. DeAndre was always a great screen setter. But he doesn't have, no center is the athlete of DeAndre, probably. But he's that same similar type of player. And you look at how much farther his defensive development is than DeAndre's at 22. I'm not saying he's going to be that caliber, first team all defense guy, but it's got to make you optimistic for he could be a really solid defender, a really solid offensive player. His free throws have progressively improved in each of his 3 years from when he was like, what was he, like 20% literally from the line his first year in the league. And now he's not good at all, but at least he's not the worst free throw shooter in the NBA by far. He just seems to be getting a little bit better at everything every year, and he's only 22 years old. He's already a legitimately good player.
Yeah, and it's easy for fans to forget that this is basically just his second season. That first year when he was a rookie and international prospect, he essentially spent that entire year at the D League, snuck in a few minutes at the very end of the year, and then actually joined the Rockets playoff rotation right at the end, ended up having a role of, you know, about 10 to 15 minutes per game as the backup behind Dwight Howard on the team that went to the Western Conference Finals a couple of years ago. But yeah, this is basically just his second full season, first as a starter. So there are going to be some growing pains. Part of what was difficult for him when he had that broken fibula middle of the year, he was really playing some great ball before then. It seemed to kind of set him back a little bit, not just physically, but mentally. He never was quite as, I shouldn't say never, but it took him a while to get the level of sharpness that he had before going out for a month with the fibula break. But, yeah, he's getting better, and the key thing for the Rockets, he has all these athletic gifts, but everyone in the organization raves about his attitude. He's just a quiet kid who works really hard, never says a bad word about anybody, and so everyone from James Harden to Mike D'Antoni to Daryl Morey, everyone is so confident in Clint, just because you get a kid like that with those athletic gifts and a right attitude. There are certain problems, but when you have a work ethic that good and that athletic package, you know, that's a great base to work with. And certainly there are still some flaws that frustrate Rockets fans from time to time, but you're right. He's getting better from year to year. It's really just his second full year as an NBA player. So yeah, there's a lot to like and a lot of reason to think that, hey, give him a couple more years and the growth may not be done. I know a lot of folks like to think that, well, by year three, you're done. But as you said, no, there's plenty of cases, DeAndre being the primary example, where you're not. So yeah, he's a good source for Rockets fans. And that's what D'Antoni talked with us about that at shoot around before game one. There was kind of a session yesterday in which he was talking about the development of Clint going up against, you know, a proven big man like Steven Adams and saying that, you know, for right now, Clint's grown into his role about 25 minutes a game. And the goal, of course, is to get him to 30, 35 minutes per game, being a true starter in terms of his stamina, physicality, et cetera, et cetera. Not there yet, but D'Antoni thinks within a year or two he can get there. And it's frustrating because, again, everybody wants immediate returns. But, yeah, there's a slow trajectory to this, and Clint's definitely on the upswing. So for Houston fans, yeah, seeing him have a game like that in the playoffs, definitely a really encouraging sign that people down here are pretty excited about.
Did you see the guy with the Bobby Brown sign last night?
Oh, yeah. That guy's awesome.
Is that guy there every game?
I think so. I have seen him there before. I don't know if he's there every game, but I've seen him. But yeah, if you have a Bobby Brown sign, you're officially my hero.
Bobby Brown came in the game last night, and I don't know what this guy would have done if it wasn't a 30-point blowout, because Bobby Brown was not coming in that game otherwise.
No.
I guess he just would have left the... So this guy had a Bobby Brown sign, and he didn't raise it until Bobby Brown actually came in the game with like 4 minutes left in the fourth quarter of a total and complete, you know, blowout and 30-point game. And he came in the game. It's just a sign that says Bobby Brown, eighth wonder. And he's jumping up and down screaming.
Oh, yeah.
As soon as screaming, freaking out. Like a 16-year-old girl in 1967
yeah.
who just saw John Lennon come out of a car. And like he is like freaking out, jumping up and down at this sign.
Yeah.
It was I lost it, man. I started laughing so hard. I lost it. It was so great.
Your goal for your Oklahoma City audience, yeah, your goal is to prevent any Bobby Brown appearances, because Bobby Brown is, he's like the human victory cigar. That's why people in Houston have such affinity for him. Well, he is a really nice guy. You know, he's a veteran. He's obviously has a roster spot because he's really tight with James Harden, and we all know that. But he's one of those guys – easy to get along with. There's the funny story. I don't know if you remember in the preseason, but when the Rockets took that trip to China, you remember what Bobby did with the Great Wall?
No, I don't know if I remember this.
Okay, well, you should Google this. It's an amazing story. Almost caused an international incident. They had to apologize. But when they went on a preseason trip to China, they played the Pelicans for two games. But Bobby Brown actually signed his name on the Great Wall of China, which is definitely a no-no. You're not supposed to do that. But yeah, he signed his name. I think he put it out on social media, and like everybody just had a great time with it because thankfully there was no international incident. The Rockets apologized. Everything was fine. But yeah, at that point, that's kind of where the legend of Bobby Brown was born, just this lovable older veteran who only plays typically when it's a really good game. Because even if you're losing, you need a spark. There are certain guys, like younger players that the Rockets might turn to, like Troy Williams is an example, someone who's not really in the rotation for this series, but the Rockets are struggling in a given game and needing a spark. They might try him because theoretically there's upside there. You know what I mean by that? It's one of those younger players that you're trying to develop. Whereas Bobby Brown, you know who he is. He's basically just a stabilizing presence into the bench. And so, yeah, if he gets in, it's victory cigar mode. And, of course, everybody on Twitter loves, you can make all the puns about, you know, it being Mike D'Antoni's prerogative to play him and all of the, you know, Bobby Brown music puns you can think of. And, yeah, so when he gets in, everybody in Houston is, yeah, pretty jumping. I guess if you're an Oklahoma City fan, that might be the one solace you can take from game one. At least you had the fun, Bobby Brown moments in the final 3 minutes that everyone, courtesy of the sign guy, could at least take a little bit of enjoyment in.
The sign was great. I wish I were able to anticipate that and take a video of that guy just freaking out. His reaction was just unbelievable.
Yeah.
What would he have done with the sign if Bobby Brown hadn't come in? Like, he had that thing pre-made and brought it to the game.
He's waiting. He's
a confident fan.
Yeah, and maybe we can get for game two. We need some Rockets fan, if you're listening out there, come in with a Bobby Brown's face photoshopped onto a victory cigar, something like that. Because, the world would be a better place with more Bobby Brown signs. I think we can agree and kind of wrap up there. Fred, thank you so much for the time. For your listeners who don't know me, I'll go and basically plug myself, and you can do the same in a moment for you and your show. I'm Ben Dubose. I work with Sports Talk 790, the official flagship radio station here in Houston, covering the Rockets. I have a blog, Talking Rockets, on that page. And, of course, I'm the host of Locked On Rockets, which is the sister podcast to your Locked On Thunder on this Locked On Podcast Network. So if anybody wants to follow me on Twitter, it's at Ben Dubose is me personally. The show is at Locked On Rockets. And, of course, you can find any of our archives right here on the same Locked On Podcast Network. You can find all of your stuff over at Locked On Thunder. So, Fred, before we close out, toss out your handles, where anybody in Houston can find your work. Basically, anything people want to know about you.
Yeah, so you can find my stuff, normantranscript.com. Check out my blog there, Thunder Road, under the sports tab on the site. You can see everything there, or you can just go to normantranscript.com/sports/Thunder Road, or you can check out my Twitter, at Fred Katz, FREDKATZ. See that there, email lockedonthunder@gmail.com. Just if you like really want to tell me how much you hate the show, you can do that. And you can send that there. Or you can tweet it at me, really whichever one. You can make like a note on your iPhone and screenshot it and send it to me if it's over 140 characters of disparaging comments, and that would be okay. And I'll probably give you a retweet if you tweet how much you hate me. So I don't know why I'm encouraging this. Now people are going to do it. But you can – anything else that I need to plug? Anything else that I do? Oh, yeah, Locked On Thunder. You can listen to Locked On Thunder and find it wherever you probably find Locked On Rockets as well.
Yeah, and I'll throw in one last plug for you. Fred, just like myself, is a Mizzou guy. We actually didn't know that about each other until very recently. But, so in addition to everything else, M-I-Z-Z-O-U – and, yeah, we can close out by, it's been a fun month for Mizzou with Michael Porter, hadn't it? That's been pretty ridiculous.
I can't believe we went through this whole podcast and it took us, like, 35 minutes to get to Michael Porter Jr.
Yeah, obviously that's the real story. Everything Rockets Thunder is bearing the lead because, a year from now, obviously Michael Porter is going to be set to be number one pick in the NBA draft after delivering a national title to Mizzou, and we're all going to be celebrating. Yeah,
man, Quanzo Martin has not coached the game, and he's already significantly better than Kim Anderson.
Yeah. Oh God. Yeah. And I wouldn't say he's already better than Frank Haith, because certainly 31 team that won the Big 12.
Frank Haith. I don't know how hot this take is. Frank Haith gets way too much crap from Mizzou fans.
Yep.
Way too much. I agree. He employed like a real offense, like a real NBA style spread pick and roll offense that looked amazing, and they weren't like his guys, but like they were that was a real offense with the spread pick and roll with Pressey and Denman and English and Ratley.
He recruited NBA talent, Jordan Clarkson, Jabari Brown, those were guys he went and found. Phil Pressey, he didn't recruit, but certainly helped develop him. I mean, he had a healthy pipeline of guards. Now, there were certain deficiencies. I thought defensively there were obvious limitations. Also, the transfer route that everyone loves to pan. I don't think it's the end of the world, but certainly it's hard to establish a true base. And so you can have the bottom fall out as it did the first year of Commanderson. But yeah, I'm with you. Frank gets too much blame. I don't think he's a particularly good coach. I just don't think he was an awful one either, responsible for the destruction of the program. I think he's just, a perfectly average coach is what I would say. And he did some good things. Certainly didn't build the program to a great spot, but certainly he's not responsible for death and destruction the way the popular Mizzou narrative leaves it anyway. So, yeah, I'm in agreement with you. Too early to put Konzo clearly ahead of Frank Haith, but God almighty, what Konzo Martin's done in the first month with Michael Porter Jr. and then hopefully Kevin Knox and Jeremiah Tillman, will have to wait and see in the next few weeks. But, yeah, it's been a hell of a run for Missouri. Anyway, we could ramble on about this all day, but I don't want to bog our listeners down too much. So, Fred, thank you so much for the time, and let's try and chat again later this series, okay?
Yeah, for sure.
Absolutely. Thanks, buddy.